Who's the main speaker for this evening? Kylie from San Diego.
All right, I got my timer going here. Sorry, audio people. I myself do some audio, so I'm trying to get you some good audio going on. I'm Kylie. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really nervous all of a sudden because I just looked up. So what's happening, people? And it just, like, went up 10 degrees in the room, too. I want to ask Joe, I want to thank Joe for asking me to speak. It's going to take me a minute to calm down. It's been a kind of an interesting day. I was on Facebook today, as usual, and I found out another girl died of a drug overdose yesterday, and it just kind of got me this afternoon. She was young, early 20s. It's taken a lot of people, this disease. So on that note, I just wanted to make sure that that I said something about her. Her name is MC, and she was a sweet girl. And I saw some posts that she had made in the last month or so, and I felt like reaching out to her. And I guess I was a little too late. But, you know, the one thing I know about this disease is that it doesn't discriminate against anyone of any age, background, nothing. And I definitely think now that there's not much that any human power can do. And the Big Book talks a lot about that, that you have to have a power greater than yourself. And I'm here to tell you that if you don't understand that or if you don't really know what that's all about, that's okay too, because all that I've really ever known is that I'm not it. And that pretty much is all that I can do some days, is that I don't quite understand the nature of God, the universe, higher power, whatever you want to call it, but all I know is that it's infinite, it's a lot larger than me, and if I run my own show all the time, it's a mess. So I'm okay with that today. And I wanted to talk about, I've been in school lately. I've been studying about everything mostly, but Alcoholics Anonymous is afforded me the opportunity to go to school and actually show up and get good grades and take care of myself in those ways. And I'm really grateful for that. And I took a neuroscience class last semester, and it was really interesting to me because I learned about not only what scientifically they base alcoholism off of, and, you know, they talk about hereditary and they talk about genetics, and what I thought was really interesting is that genetically, people that are true alcoholics, we lack an enzyme called alcohol dehydrogenase, and that enzyme is responsible for creating a buildup of another subparticle after alcohol is broken down in our system. And it actually, in normal people, this enzyme is prevalent to the point where it actually makes you feel really, really sick, and it gives you the effects that most people get after drinking too much, and so you stop. But with us, we lack that if you are truly alcoholic in that way, and it also produces that phenomenon of craving. And so we talk a lot about an AA because the Big Book was written in 1939, so a lot of this information wasn't available at the time, you know, like the study of the human brain was in its infancy, and I don't think that a lot of people realize that, yes, we are actually physiologically different than our fellows. So I always hear people talk about, if you're allergic to strawberries, you're not going to go eat a bunch of strawberries, you know, but it's that insane, you know, something about, and I don't know about you, but when I took a drink, like, my first drink that I took, or my first drunk that I actually got drunk, I blacked out. And I got really sick And that was probably my body saying, hey, knock it off, you know. But for me, I was like, I got to do that again. And next time, I got to do it so that, like, I can get my tolerance up to where that I don't get sick anymore, because that was really awesome. And I would just like to live completely anesthetized. Thank you very much, you know. And that was how I was, you know, at 14. But I was way more screwed up before that in my head, because another thing I'd like to talk about is that I think we all come from totally different backgrounds. You know, my childhood was no better or no worse than a lot of people in this room. It just is what it is, you know? And I'm sure that we're all still here, so that's good, you know? We might have some issues, but it doesn't quite make me alcoholic to have these issues. Now, do I want to numb out because some of it's painful? Yeah, you know? But my best friend Dawn and I used to drink together. She was the last person I drank with. And she came from a pretty good background. Her parents were married. You know, I used to go over there and steal ice cream out of their freezer because they were so adorable of a family that they actually had ice cream of like five different kinds in their freezer. And I was like the misfit child that would go over there, and they're like, you know, Kylie's going to go steal the ice cream, you know. And they thought it was cute. And I was kind of the adopted kid because I was an only child and my mom was always gone working. And my dad took off when I was 13. And so, you know, but her and I drank alike, but she came from a pretty good background, and I came from a pretty dysfunctional background. And I still question whether she's alcoholic or not to this day, and I hope that if she is, that someday she'll know where to come, because she's known that I've been sober this whole time. But, you know, it really, you know, that's another thing that science can't even figure out, is how we can come from different backgrounds and we have different life experiences. And really what it is that everybody's wired differently. Some people can do a bunch of cocaine and become schizophrenic. Some people can do a bunch of cocaine and live 30 years and still commit crime and do, you know, and never make it in these rooms. I don't know why it's so different for everyone. I don't understand that. And I think that's the most frustrating thing, because I think being an Alcoholics Anonymous, knowing that there's a solution, knowing that you can stay sober through anything, and not being able to give that to somebody is the hardest thing for me. I don't know about you. And I think, like, when I was new, I was trying to get everybody sober. I remember being in my, like, first 6 months, and I was like, well, you know, maybe you need to work the steps. And I was 22. No one wanted to listen to me. I don't know why. You know? And it was really hard to sponsor people when I was young, because, well, I'm still fairly young, you know, so it was hard to sponsor people when I was young because nobody thought I had any validity, you know. And then I started telling them stories, and they're like, yeah, maybe you need to be here, you know. And so let me back up a little. I'm from the Midwest. My dad is an alcoholic. Well, I'm not going to diagnose him. He hasn't yet diagnosed himself, so I'll be fair. But he might be one of us. And, you know, it's funny because you can take alcohol away from that guy and he can make the most insane decisions that still place him in positions to get hurt and to be a mess all the time. And he's like, you know, nearing 60. And I feel really bad for him because he doesn't get this gift that I've gotten, you know, and he knows it's here. I dragged him to a convention once. So he knows it's here. I was trying to get him sober. Didn't work. And never does. And I think I had 2 years at the time. And I think I was still trying to create a father that I never had. And I remember calling my sponsor at the time, and she got mad at me. And she said, will you just knock it off? Like, I know it's painful, but you cannot expect this man to be your father. He never was. He didn't even sign up for it, so just stop, you know. And I thought she was really awful for saying that to me. And I was sitting there in my tent because it was up in Mammoth. I mean, we have some really beautiful conventions and get-togethers in AA. Like, they had this retreat up in Mammoth that I used to go on every year, and it was awesome during the summertime. And I'm sitting there in this beautiful wilderness in my tent crying to my sponsor on the phone. And, you know, she was right. She was right. Our parents, you know, our caretakers, whoever it is, they did the best that they could given the tools that they had, you know. My dad was also from a very alcoholic home, and his father was incredibly abusive. And I'm coming from the Midwest, where everybody really likes guns a lot, and they like to go shooting. and they chew tobacco, and that's the way they roll. And some of you think that's cool. I don't know. You might need some therapy. Not judging. I heard a woo in the back. I don't know who it was. Anyhow, I was really, actually really embarrassed about my childhood because, you know, my uncles were really not cool. They were really redneck, and I was really, I felt too elitist to be stuck in the Midwest. And my mom is a pure codependent. She just has, like, stamped on her forehead, you know, like, you can just feel it, you know, when she walks into a room, because she's always worrying about what everybody else is doing. It's funny, we went to a grief support group the other night, and I'll tell you all about this later, but we went around the room, and the leader of the group said, "What are you doing to take care of yourself today?" And she was like, "Well, I'd actually recommend massage to everyone in the room right now." And I'm like, and my little receptors went off, and I was sitting there all angry. After 10 years of sobriety, I'm still like this with my mother, you know? I'm like, she asked about you, not everyone else, you know? Anyways, but, so you get the picture. Anyway, she's a really nice lady, and I'm very grateful for her, actually. You know, she puts up with my insanity, too, and we actually do really well because I'm sober, you know? Thank God. So we moved because my dad kept quitting his jobs when I was a kid, so we moved out to California. Thank God. I actually should thank him for being a screw-up when I was a kid, because we wouldn't have moved here if it weren't for that, because there was this huge construction boom in the late 80s, so we moved everything out to California. And so we ended up out here, and I was this real quiet kid. I had a lot of bad stuff happen to me as a kid, and because my parents worked a lot, and they weren't really paying attention to what was going on. And my mom was really naive. She was from Greensburg, Kansas. I don't know if any of you know where that is, but it literally, there's 1,000 people there still to this day. And it was flattened by a tornado, and then they rebuilt it because Leonardo DiCaprio went in and created a TV show, and they rebuilt the city, and now there's still 1,000 people, but it's all new now. And anyhow, so she was just a real naive person until I became a teenage alcoholic and taught her a thing or two. But I I'm really grateful that we made it out here, and I just remember that my experiences getting to know people and my first day at first grade, I pushed the little boy down who cut in front of me in line, you know, and I was a very silent kid, and I just didn't like that. I was like, no, you know, you're not going to get in my way, and that's all I had to do. I didn't have to say anything to him. I just pushed him, and he cried, and I got in trouble, and you know, I acted out in these really silent, kind of brooding, controlling ways because I was just in a lot of pain. My home life wasn't awful. It was the things that had kind of happened to me as a result of my parents not really being around. And so I was in therapy from when I was like 4 on. And I'm really grateful for that, too, because if it weren't for that, I don't know what would have happened to me before I started drinking, because I didn't have a solution before that. So I didn't really make good friends. I didn't feel like anybody understood me. I had really, really bad OCD. Like, I couldn't touch anything. I would wash things, and I would wash my hands till they bled. And that was, like, my first way of controlling my environment, was just controlling everything that was around, and what I ate, and what I touched, and, you know, how I could stay clean, and everything. It was just, it was terrifying, and I was like 11 by this time, and I really needed to drink. Like, people talk about that, and that probably would have been great, you know, if at that age somebody had been like, here you go, here's a magic elixir, so you don't have to freak out, you know, you don't have to wash your hands 70 times a day, like, maybe this will help, because, like, I don't know about you, but when I'm loaded, I don't care what's clean, what's dirty, where I sleep, you know. It's awesome because it's just no worry land, you know, until the shit starts hitting the fan in other ways. But I started drinking hard at 14. Like, the first night I drank, I blacked out. I continued to black out every time I drank. I introduced new substances here and there. They'd get a little spooky. I'd be up for a little too long. It would freak me out. I'd drink again. I'd do other things. I'd try to do other things and then drink at the same time, and certain things would ruin my drinking, and then certain things I didn't care if they ruined my drinking, and then, you know, I got my license taken away when I was 16 before I even really got it in the mail because I got caught at San Onofre with some open containers, and I was a big wuss, so I cried the whole way home, and my friends were really angry at me in the car. They're like, just shut up, okay? Like, what's wrong with you, you know? Because I'm very emotional. I'm alcoholic. I'm very emotional as an individual, you know? And I could care less what if they got in trouble. I just was sad because my mom was going to yell at me and all this and that. And they'd taken away my license, and then I got it. I got my license back, and then I got it taken away again. And then I got my license back, and then I got a DUI, you know. And so I drove on a suspended license for like 3 years. And I don't know about you, but I love to drink and drive, you know. And I had a little lowered 2000 Civic. It was silver, and it had an exhaust on the back, and tinted windows. I had to get the windows like fixed. They gave me a fix-it ticket but I loved it because you could put the bong in the back, no one would notice. And that was like that was what I drove around in, you know. I was like 19 and I thought I was awesome, and I would drive it like 120 everywhere drunk. And before the 56 was built, you know, it used to just be like old, you know, dirt and stuff, and we'd throw keggers out there, and I don't know how I didn't die, like, then, you know, just doing that stuff, because, I mean, I did wreck 3 cars. I did total 3 cars, and I think that if you have 1 car that dies of alcoholism, you might be an alcoholic, but if you have, like, 3 cars that die of alcoholism by the time you're 20, there's a serious issue going on, and I don't know why my mom kept buying me new cars, but I'm really glad at the time she was such an, like, untreated Al-Anon, you know? It was just, like, awesome, because she's like, oh, well, I'll try fixing it, and then I'll give you a new one. And my mom didn't have money, you know? I grew up she was a single parent working her butt off just trying to support us, and we were in debt, and we didn't have any money, but, you know, God bless her, like, I can't believe she put up with me like that. I would have kicked my ass out, you know. We'll see, though, when my daughter grows up. I'm sure it's harder than I say. So, but, you know, one day I came home. One night I was driving home drunk again. And the last drink I had was October 3rd of 2004. And it was at Pounders in Escondido. That's my spot. Yeah, see you guys out there. You'd like Pounders. And I went home with some random guy. I don't remember what he even looks like, you know. I don't know his name or anything. I'm seeing what time I got here. And I remember, I think I was wasted. And I remember sort of asking him, like, hey, man, I don't want to sleep with you. Can we just cuddle? And because I was kind of going a little bit nuts at the point, because I was like trying to micromanage my other substances, and then I would like stop doing that for a while, but I couldn't. I remember a couple months, I guess, before this incident. I mean, let me back up a little. I almost died a couple different times from taking illicit substances and mixing it with booze, and ending up in the hospital, you know, next to the crash kit. And waking up and going, whoops, you know, didn't mean to do that. And that started scaring me. That was the beginning of the end, because I thought, ooh, like, you can really die easy. You know, that's how I felt at that time. And I really didn't want to die, but I didn't know of any other alternative. And I remember this moment where I used to hang out with these guys that were like twice my age, because they always had good booze and good drugs, and they were, you know, settled, and they had houses and stuff to go to. So I would go to these parties at my friend's house, who was like 40 at the time, and I think I was like 20, and we'd go over there. And I remember one night I was like, I'm not going to drink. I'm going to do some other stuff, but I'm not going to drink tonight. And I looked across the room at a bottle of I think it was Captain Morgan, and it was calling my name. And I felt that craving, that insatiable urge to, like there was nothing that would stand between me and that instance of me picking up that bottle. And so I did. I drank. I couldn't not drink. And I remember thinking, okay, I can't not drink. Like, in the morning I have to drink. And there were bottles hidden all over my room. And my mom knew, but she just kind of turned a blind eye and went to work and just didn't know what to do for me. And so I kept doing what I was doing. And a lot of other bad stuff happened to me, as stuff happens when you're a girl and you're an alcoholic and you're always in a blackout. But it wasn't traumatizing because I could drink it away. It wasn't traumatizing until I got sober and I had to get, you know, therapy for it and work steps on it and clean up that kind of wreckage, which is still, you know, an issue sometimes. But it's 10 times better than it used to be. So anyhow, I came home one night after I left that guy's house, and I was hiding underneath a lifted truck in his where all the cars were in the carport, because I thought that he was after me because I left and I wasn't going to sleep with him. And I had stolen some CDs I'd stole some Misfits burned CDs out of his CD player. I mean, I was just nuts, you know? And I wasn't even on drugs. Like, I was just drinking, you know, hard at the end. And I was just delusional. I was losing it. And I was like 175 pounds, and I was puffy and red. And the doctor, the last time I ended up in the hospital, was like, "Do you have a death wish?" You know? And I was 22. I was just a mess. And nothing was working right. Like, I wasn't eating or anything. And I was drinking in the morning. I would drink Schlitz malt liquor with my friend Patsy, who was a homeless, like, 50-year-old person. And she liked to drink Schlitz. And, like, no one else would drink Schlitz with me at, like, 7 in the morning, you know? So I'd go to her house, or not her house, she didn't live in a house. I would go to her boyfriend's house, who would allow her to come and wash her clothes there, and I'd buy us some Schlitz malt liquors, you know, tall cans, and I'd go over there and I'd hang out with her at 7 o'clock in the morning so that I could, you know, work off, stay drunk, you know, always stay drunk. And so anyhow, I ended up coming home that night after I left that guy's house, and I was drunk, and I had a moment of clarity on the way home, and I didn't get in trouble that night. I didn't end up in jail that night. I wasn't arrested that night. I didn't end up in the hospital. I just realized for the first time that every decision that I've made was linked to my drinking. Like, that was bad. And then I was probably going to die, because I had already almost died a couple times. So if I continued doing it, I was going to die. And then I thought, what kind of weirdo wants to die at 22? What am I doing, you know? Who would want to die at any age just because you can't, like, you feel like you don't have control over a substance? It's insane, right? But that's what I thought. I'm like, well, I'm just going to die because I can't stop. And that's how I felt. And so I got home, and then I told my mom, I was like, all right, you know, I want to go to rehab. And she listened for the first time. And the next day, she's like, all right, you know, you want to go this weekend? And I was like, yeah, just send me on Sunday. Let's go. And it was like on a Friday. So I did some more stuff that next day because I knew I was going to go to rehab. Which was ridiculous because I would have gotten way more wasted if I would have known I was going to stay sober. No, just joking. But it was kind of ridiculous. Like, I should have, you know, I just wanted to go. I wanted a different way of life. I just didn't know what that looked like. And so I went off to rehab, and I was there for 90 days, and it felt like a damned eternity. And I hated everybody I was in my rehab with because, you know, I was still completely egocentric and self-centered and going, you know, they don't treat us right here. And then for some reason, I picked up the phone and I called this lady I had asked to sponsor me, because at the rehab they said, you can't stay here unless you get a sponsor. And I wish more places were like that these days, because I didn't even know what a sponsor was. I just did it because they told me to, and they're like, you need to get a job within 3 weeks of being here or you're out. You have to get, you know, if you want your cell phone or your car back or anything like that. And cell phones just came out, so I didn't really care because I still had like a page or two. But you know, they said, if you want these things back, then you have to do X, Y, and Z. And I was like, okay. And I must have just been willing enough at the time because I really had nothing going on, you know. And so I called this woman, Beth, actually, we're still really, really close friends. And she said, you know, I'm going to come over tomorrow. We're going to start reading the Big Book. And so she came over the next day, and we started reading the Big Book. And I did not understand a damn word. All that I thought was weird was when it would talk about alcoholism, I was like, yeah, duh. I mean, if you're relating to it and you think it's ridiculous and redundant because you're relating to it, then you're probably an alcoholic, okay? Like, I didn't put that together because I was too in a fog. And all I kind of remember about my first 2 years was doing what she told me to do. And then I started working. And then I started learning how to pay rent. And I still didn't know what I was doing. But I do remember very clearly the day that I did my first inventory, my first fifth step with her. Because I had showed up with, the God thing, before I talk about the inventory, the God thing. A lot of people come in here and they always talk about, you know, God, they say God too much, God, you know. And it's like, for me, it's just, I'm really not trying to completely understand what that is. I've stayed sober for 10 years. I hope if I keep doing the work that I'll continue to stay sober. But sometimes just humbling myself to the fact that, like, there's this thing going on that I can't explain other than I feel it and I see it in the faces of the people around me and the love and the light and the intense things that have happened also. And that's the only thing I can really relate God to, you know? And I'm all right with that today, you know? So if you don't know what God is, it's cool. Like I said in the beginning, you don't have to know. It's just you're not it. So stop running your fucking show. You know, that's really... I mean, people had to drill that into my head because I'm very self-will run riot. I mean, and I want to thank my sponsor, Pat, for coming out tonight, and my sober sister, Jennifer. And it's cool. And my other friends that I see in the room that I didn't even know were going to be here. And thank you, Christian. And, like, all these wonderful people that I've known in sobriety who put up with me. And I love very much, you know. So I really didn't have that much of an issue with the God thing. I was just kind of like floating through life anyways, like, okay, cool, I think I can dig that, you know? And so when my fourth step came up and I went to go read it to her, it was really intense because I had no idea that showing up with a list of resentments and this hatred I had for others and this anger and this sadness I had for others and how I used to call my dad when I was 17 and blame him for the reason that I was as screwed up as I was, and I'd be drunk on the phone with him, you know, like, it's all your fault, you know, this is why I'm a mess, and it's always going to be why I'm a mess, and, you know, I could ride that train for a really long time blaming him, because it's easier than looking at my own part, you know. So I showed up to that fifth step meeting with her not knowing that I was going to find out how selfish I was and how many issues that I had that I needed to really take a good look at and, you know, find a new way of life and not just blame you for everything. And that was weird. And I started finally, I remember that day clearly because I remember starting to think, this is what it's about. Oh, you know, like you can come in completely not believing in God. And you start going through the step work and you're like, lights start clicking and it will show you like this whole other part of yourself that you weren't even ready to see, you know? And I was so grateful. And I remember her telling me, okay, so, you know, there's this list of defects, you know, and it seems like you're a little selfish, self-righteous, maybe, you know. Maybe you have a little bit of control issues and just thinking that, you know, the list went on, right? But then she also said you have assets, and I'm sure a lot of those defects were used in ways that actually benefited you in your life too, you know? But now I need you to go, I need you to do 6 and 7. I need you to sit quietly for an hour. I need you to go over this list of defects. I need to do the seven-step prayer. And you know, and I did. I did what she told me to. I sat there, and I became willing to have them removed. It doesn't say, like, they're removed. When you decide that they are removed, they are gone. And your higher power or the universe or God or whatever you want to call it, it's like, it's cool, just take away your selfishness forever and you'll be fine, you know? Like, that's not the way that it works. It's, you know, it's I'm willing to recognize them every day. I'm willing to give them up so that I don't totally destroy everything in my life around me, because I'm dysfunctional by nature. You know, I didn't have anybody when I was growing up to teach me how not to be dysfunctional, because they had learned from other dysfunctional people that, you know, we'll just continue it down the line. You know, I was the first person in my family that ever didn't have to die from alcoholism and could come into AA and actually, like, change the behavior, you know? And that's a lot of pressure on one person, but... You know, and especially when you want everybody else to change because you're changing, and it doesn't work that way. You know, my sponsor lovingly reminds me that my mother and other people in my life might not have a program, but I do, so I have to not be a jerk, you know. So I have to do the work on it, right? And I'm grateful for that too. And anyway, my life started changing immensely, and you know, I started making amends. I was willing to make those amends. I made a list of people that I had harmed, you know, and I became willing to make amends to them if it was not to harm them or others. And weird things started happening. Like, I was living in Orange County at the time. I came down here for a concert. And I had a group of friends that were in a band out of Poway and when I was younger. And so we went to their show, and my ex-boyfriend, who I was alcoholic with, was at the show, and he was the first person on my amends list, and he just happened to be there. And I don't know, man, like, something's at work here, even if you want to call it a massive energy, like, you know, that's weird, okay, like, it gets, see, I'm getting goosebumps because it's spooky, like, it's not like, I'd be like, whatever, God, you know, but it's so weird how it just happens like that. And I've heard tons of stories from everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous about these random places that you could be like in Antarctica and you're like, I just happened to run into this person that I screwed over and I owed like $2,000. And I was like, hey, buddy, you know what I mean? It's like, how does that happen? Right. And I'm so grateful for those moments, you know? And so I made amends to him and I became free. And I was like, whoa, this is what it's about. And it was just another one of those moments where it started making more and more sense of what this program really is about. And you get to the amends, and it's like we talk about the promises, like before we're halfway through, we start receiving the promises, you know, we become intuitive. We no longer fear, you know, insecurity of really any sort, you know, especially monetarily, like financially, like we don't have to, we learn so much about everything around us because of these really cool things that start happening. And when we talk about before we're halfway through, we're talking about the ninth step. We're talking about making amends, because I've seen a lot of people go out after doing an inventory and just not being willing to make their amends. You know, I used to think, oh, if I just get my sponsees through their inventory. No, that's bullshit, because it's not going to keep them here. You know, we have to be willing to right the wrongs. We have to be really to open our, thank you. We have to be willing to open ourselves up, you know? And life is so good when you get all that stuff kind of cleared up. And don't get me wrong, like, you keep screwing up through sobriety. Especially, you know, I was going through my 20s too, so I was just like, I don't know what's going on, you know, like, I'm a mess, you know, and I still make stupid choices and decisions, you know, but the cool thing is I have these tools to keep righting the wrongs, you know, and my mistakes now are 10 times better than they ever were when I was loaded, you know. And the cool things that happened, like I started going to school and I got a degree, and then, you know, I met a guy. I met a couple guys, but my first boyfriend ever in sobriety, he's still sober too. And that's a gift. And we've talked, and we still love each other after all these years. He lives in Chicago, has a wife, and they just have their first baby. you know, we were young in sobriety when we met, and it was really hard. As a lot of you might find out, as a lot of you have found out, you know, it's relationships are the hardest kind of things to get through when you're sober, because you just don't know how to do anything, and it's always in your face, you know, and you are always in your face, like with the defects, and then you gotta make amends all the time. But it's a beautiful way to live, you know, especially in relationships. Because then you can really truly get a real connection with people, you know. You actually have to try to be committed, and that's hard for alcoholics like me, you know. And you know, I dated another guy that is dry. He quit going to the program after we broke up, but, you know, love him dearly, still know his family, still cool with them. I mean, I have these friends that we just care about each other, even if we're not around each other all the time, you know, because we know that we're pretty good people, you know. And, you know, I met Adam when I was 5 years sober, and he had 7 months. But he was pretty. And I fell in love really hard with him. And nothing, wild horses could not tear me away from that guy. Like, and I knew it was a bad idea. Mm-hmm. But we just had a connection that I can't even explain to people. And some of you in this room knew him. And you know, he tried to get this thing. He tried to, but he couldn't get honest with himself or others, because he couldn't get honest with himself. He tried, you know, his angle all the time. Like, well, I'll get a commitment, but I'll get loaded on the side, and maybe if I just have a commitment while I'm getting loaded, no one will know that I'm still getting loaded. And it was just infuriating and frustrating, and I tried everything in 5 years' time. I was like, you know, I went to Al-Anon. I tried to, like love him sober. I tried to kick him out sober, you know, like tried to do a lot of things, and then I got pregnant with our daughter. And he informed me when I was 7 months pregnant that he had tried a heroin for the first time that month before. And I kind of knew at the time that he had signed his death certificate. I don't know how, I just knew it was a deep, deep darkness that settled over me. And he never came back from it. It was really hard, and I had to make a lot of decisions that people had told me early in that relationship in the program. They said, leave him alone for a year. Make him stay sober for a year before you talk to him again. But when I got pregnant, I was not willing to do that. I was terrified, and I was like, I can't do this. I can't do this alone. And my largest fears were realized, you know, because I was like, he's going to come out of it. He's going to stay sober. It's going to be okay, you know. And so I tried to love him from afar for a while, and he went to the Freedom Ranch for the second time right when I had the baby, January of 2013. And I had the baby, and I would take her. I would drive out to the Freedom Ranch every week, starting when she was 2 weeks old, to introduce him to his daughter and to just try to show up. And he never looked better than when he was at the damn Freedom Ranch, because you're out there in the damn middle of nowhere, you know what I mean? Meditating on a rock, you know, feeling all spiritual, getting fed 3 meals a day, you know, watching random weird movies. And it's great, you know, a lot of people have stayed sober through that, and I'm grateful for that. And but the instant he came down off that mountain, he relapsed. And it was devastating, and I found him with drugs in our house, and I was like, you're done. And for the first time in my life with him, I had to cut him off completely, and I said, you're not going to see your daughter again until you get a year of sobriety, because I cannot put her or my family in jeopardy anymore. And it was the hardest damn decision I've ever had to make, because I loved him. And I did it with the help of my sponsorship, Al-Anon, you know, women in the program, men in the program, like, people just helped me, you know, during that time. And I was terrified, and I had a new baby, and I had postpartum, and I was a mess, you know, and I was going to school. I went to school all the way up through my pregnancy. After she was brand new, I went through Adam's relapses. I mean, I was still going, just trying to make something of myself, you know? And I was still going to meetings, and I was still working steps. I mean, all of that stuff. Because I was taught when I got here that the thing about it, like, it's a self-motivated program. I have to constantly check myself. If I'm not checking in and I'm not doing the work, I've got to constantly go, I need to go, I need to get into it again. I need to do this, you know, like, this is important, because if I don't have sobriety, you know, Larry, like, he said tonight, he's like, you know, as long as I put AA first, you know, and everything else after. And it's so true, you know, and I've tried to tell people that over the years, and there's nothing else I can really say to someone else, but that's what I have to do. That's what I have to do, because I'm not very well when I'm not working a program. Because you can take drugs and alcohol out of my system, and I'm still kind of nuts. So, but, you know, in a good way, too, because I'm very spunky, and I'm still the life of the party. And, you know, and I just have to say that, you know, he passed away May 21st of last year. And, you know, I still talk to him a lot, and I mean, funny things will happen. Like, Quinn, our daughter, is precocious and beautiful. He was beautiful. She's beautiful. And she'll say something like, Mama, I want a pickle. And I'm, give me some pickles. And I can hear him go, well, she's Jewish. Give her some pickles. You know, because he was Jewish. And I just, it's like, if you knew Adam, these things happen. And it's like, I know he's there. Or I just know it, you know. And he was hilarious. And, you know, we've had so many friends die in the last year, just over and over and over again. And I sat in the car and I cried for half an hour about MC today, because she was like, I don't even know, like 23 or something. She's so young and beautiful and precocious. And she wanted to do it her way, you know. She wasn't willing to let go and surrender, and it sucks to let go and surrender, but it's actually the winning side, you know. And I'm so grateful that for a small amount of time, when I first got sober, that I was willing to do something different than what I wanted to do, because it is seconds and inches. That they always say that in meetings. I always hear, I've been hearing it for 10 years now, like seconds and inches, you know. It's like these little moments of time where we're given this reprieve. And somehow this has afforded me a life that is beyond what I would have ever had if I was still drinking. And I don't think I'd lived, because I was not good at not dying. Like, I was like, damn it, I'm in the hospital again? Where am I, you know? And I looked a lot different than I do now, man. Like, sobriety treats you a lot better, you know. Like, then, like, we come in here haggard, you know. And I know people that, like, their livers were failing. Like their entire bodily functions were shutting down. And, like, they've been sober for 30 years and they're still alive. It's like, how is that even possible? You know what I mean? So I think, you know, the message I have tonight is, don't worry about all the other crap. You know, like, it's all going to come. It's all going to come. You know, the only thing that I can say is surrender yourself to this program. Because this is what will create a life beyond your wildest dreams. And I'd just like to thank everybody for being here tonight. I don't think it's a coincidence that certain people were here. I love you. And I am forever grateful, even though I can be snarky and angry and filled with grief lately because of Adam and Barrett and Jimmy, and like, I could just like go on and on, and MC, and you know, like all these people that are gone now. But I'm so grateful, and they would be grateful too that we continue to carry the message for the people that couldn't get it, you know, because this is the only thing I have left is my voice. So thank you for letting me speak tonight.